This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Well, Nick Redfern really needs no introduction on Dreamland. He's back with us today. He has been one of our most popular guests over the years, been on the show many, many times, and today he's going to come and blow our minds, infuriate some of us, because he's taken an interesting position on the Roswell incident. Holy writ in the UFO community is that alien spacecraft crashed. The Air Force got tangled up in its own bootstraps lying about it, and bodies were recovered. They were extraterrestrials, not human beings. Nick, you seem to have come up with another idea.
Well, yeah, this is actually one that I've been pursuing, well, I won't say on and off, but it's periodically near material surface, but going back through to 2001, so for the last 16 years, and it's a very controversial angle because it sort of replaces the alien aspect of the Roswell event with a sort of a series of dark and dubious, controversial human experimentation to explain the case. Now, you know, when you said at the beginning about it's either going to, you know, intrigue or outrage people, I agree. There's no sort of middle ground on this particular story. And basically what I did was to write the book so people could see the information, you know, I've uncovered. I don't believe in sort of hammering down people's throats belief systems, because I think that's the wrong way to approach something like this. I think the regardless of which side of the fence people are on when they read the book, I think, you know, the responsible way to do it is hopefully the way that I have done it, which is to present the data that I've found and then let the readers see that data and, you know, digest it and see where it all goes, you know.
Well, let's get started about your findings, talking about your findings, because we have, you know, really almost holy writ. For example, Phil Corso, who is much respected by people in the UFO community for the most part, believed or stated that he actually saw alien bodies, which you mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
And what would you say was actually going on there? Let's start there. That's an interesting place, I think, to start.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, the Corso story is so specific and so sort of on point when it comes to what Corso said he saw and handled and helped to, you know, seed into the U.S. Economy and industry, etc. It's so specific and on point that it can only be, you know, a real story or a completely non-truthful story. That there's no middle ground because there's nothing hazy. Excuse me. There's nothing hazy about the story. You know, he talks about how the technology was fed into certain U.S. Companies and back engineered. So, you know, there's nothing vague. So, you know, you either have to be one side of the fence or the other. Now, the reason why I mentioned Corso in the book is because one of the little or lesser known things about all this is that going back to 2001, a lot of the people I interviewed said that when the Second World War came to an end, and this is actually verifiable, literally thousands and thousands of tens of thousands of pages of documentation was secretly brought over from Japan from a very controversial unit called Unit 731, which did all sorts of disturbing experiments on people sort of in relation to things like high-altitude exposure and things like this. And it turns out that one of Corso's closest friends and allies in the military was a man named Major General Charles Willoughby. And it turns out that Charles Willoughby was actually the guy who oversaw the transfer of all this Japanese material on Unit 731 and human experimentation.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Let's back up again a little bit. Unit 731, what was that?
Well, Unit 731 was basically an arm of the Japanese military, and what they did all sorts of terrible experiments in the name of science, sort of kind of the Japanese equivalent of Joseph Mengele you know, sort of literally mutilating people and exposing them to high pressure, low pressure, amputating limbs and attaching them to different people to see how if the limbs would take or not. And it was just, a lot of it was just sort of crazed technology. Now, just about everybody I interviewed for the book said that of particular interest in the immediate post-war era was grabbing the Unit 731 files to figure out exactly what was going on with, for example, exposure to high pressure, low pressure, because this would have become a sort of a primary part of, you know, the early fringes of what turned into the space program. In other words, you know, determining how people would be exposed into high altitude situations. So a lot of the Japanese files were brought over to the US purely for the people who were working in the, you know, the early stages of what would become the space program. And it turns out that one of Corso's closest friends was Major General Charles Willoughby. And Charles Willoughby oversaw the transfer of all the Unit 731 material and actually shared that material and data with Corso. So, in other words, the theory I'm following is that if the story that I was told is true and is not disinformation, that Corso was certainly not involved in the whole Unit 731 thing of the transfer of material, but knew about it. And because his friend and colleague Charles Willoughby oversaw it, that this may point to a possibility of helping to cover the Japanese angle to Roswell by putting out this particular book the day after Roswell in 97, which is definitively extraterrestrial in nature. Now, of course, that's a very controversial theory, but within this issue of looking at the alternative theory for Roswell, we do find numerous Japanese threads throughout the story. And the Corso Willoughby Unit 731 is an example of that.
And what happened? What sort of experiments do we know they did?
Right. Well, as I said, had the Second World War not come to an end when the Hiroshima and Nagasaki were bombed and Japan then quickly surrendered, had that not happened, Unit 731 would almost certainly have continued. Now, they did things like, for example, expose people to dangerous viruses, that kind of thing, and you know, use various antidotes to try and see if, you know, they worked or not, amputating limbs and attaching them to different people, experiments on the eyes, trying to change eye color, which is also something that Joseph Mengele tried to do, who was an equally nutty kind of character as well.
Well, more than nutty, he was a monster.
Yeah, he was. He was, you know, there's no justification for pretty much anything he did. You know, he was just totally warped. And that was the same with the Unit 731 people. But at the sort of forefront, although there was obviously no sort of space program back then, but one of the things the Japanese were looking at was to create, had the war have gone on, was to create these gigantic balloons which would essentially fly across the jet stream, across the Pacific, and reach the US. And they would be like a kamikaze balloon kind of thing, with gondolas and with crews on board. These were like a follow-on to the so-called Fugo balloon bombs that the Japanese sent out in the Second World War, which are sort of far more flimsy and simple balloons, but they had these bombs attached. But had the war gone on, the Japanese were planning to send these gigantic, I mean literally gigantic balloons across the Pacific with crews on board. And the files actually talk about how they were going to train sort of relatively short guys, like 5 feet tall, because weight and size was a premium. And of course that didn't happen because the war came to an end. But when all the files were collected, many of those files related to these new designs that the Japanese had for these gigantic balloons, and that was incorporated into some of the post-war balloon technology in the United States. And when you realize that was in conjunction with, you know, training guys who were small in height to fly these balloons across the Pacific, then you have sort of the two of the components that some people talked about with Roswell, the small bodies and this massive field of balloon-like materials. So basically, we're not talking about the Japanese secretly continuing to fight in the Second World War, nothing like that. It's like the equivalent of the German paperclip program, where all the German scientists and papers and files and technology was brought over to White Sands. A lesser-known Japanese equivalent of paperclip went on to bring scientists over, people who were looking into this high-altitude exposure angle, and also the blueprints and files and documents for these massive balloons that were going to be built and tested. And according to the people who I spoke to, said were tested in New Mexico, and one of them came down on the Foster Ranch and led with the, you know, the relatively small crew and led to the legend of the Roswell UFO crash. Now, again, I'm sure some of the listeners to the show are going to say either I've been duped, I've sold my soul, or I'm mistaken. And, well, none of those theories are correct. The correct theory is, I think the theory is fascinating, and it does have legs attached to it. And I feel that it's important to address the story, address the theory, and put it all out there so people can make their own mind up and see how they feel about this particular theory versus the alien one. Does it stand up? Does it have aspects to the story which, you know, could explain the various aspects of the case itself? And so, you know, that essentially is the story. The thread begins in Japan and then comes to the US with these human experimentation and these gigantic balloons.
Which is, I just, you know, have to wonder whether or not this is true. And the reason is, I've got to do a break for our Free Dreamlanders. So Free Dreamlanders, enjoy these announcements. And above all, do what you're told. We'll be right back. And if you're an old subscriber to UnknownCountry.com, did you know that you have to re-up in order to keep your subscription renewing? It's not renewing automatically now unless you have entered the subscriber section, gone to your account, clicked on your account info on the upper right, input your credit card information, clicked on update account, then clicked on renew, and renewed. Your renewal will start not today, but when your current account ends. Then renewal will be automatic until you uncheck the auto-renew box, in which case it will cease to be automatic. But right now, if you're an old subscriber and haven't been in there for a while, it is not renewing automatically, and we need you to come back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on UnknownCountry.com dates back to 2004 and contains nearly 700 episodes. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world. Help keep us on the air by subscribing to UnknownCountry.com today. Go to UnknownCountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab on the right side of the masthead. Dreamland, where wonder is spoken.
We're back with Nick Redfern. His new book, The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, Exposing a Shocking and Sinister Secret. And Nick, I have to tell you, to my thinking, you've got a kind of an uphill battle here. And here's one of the reasons. I have been involved for many years in the study of materials, and so has Jacques Vallée. And Dr. Vallée at the Contact in the Desert UFO conference presented some information about isotopic ratios in materials that both of us from in different ways have obtained that were supposedly from the Roswell crash. Now, the work that Jacques has done is very
high level of scientific finish. There's been a lot of money spent on this, and the very best materials science that can be done has been done, and what has been found is that some of these materials have isotopic ratios that are not found on Earth, that are not found, as far as we understand nature, anywhere in nature, that had to have been somehow created. But there, we are not even close to being able to do that in this world. There's no classified program. There's nothing that can do it. We have no idea how to do it, even. And yet, there it is. In addition to that, the materials that we studied, not for isotopes, but for composition, we found a layered magnesium bismuth foam. The magnesium, I should say, was foamed. The bismuth was in a thin layer. But under the scanning electron microscope, there was nothing binding them. In other words, nothing bound the two layers. There's simply clear space between them. So how does it even hold together? We were absolutely at a loss, not only about how the magnesium had been affected in the way it was, but also how the thing could even exist. And we're going to do further study on all of this material. I'm getting the material that I have to Jacques shortly, and a major amount, there's a significant amount of funding here because it's very expensive work that he's doing. But how do you square that with the idea that this was really a balloon from Japan? Because I don't see where those materials could have anything whatsoever to do with anything terrestrial, let alone all that time ago.
Well, when you talk about, you know, sort of having an uphill battle, I mean, I do. I admit that. But again, you know, what I'm doing with the book is not sort of force feeding this theory down people's throats, because, you know, as I said, that's the wrong way to do it as I see it, because it becomes like, you know, you're like the preacher on stage, you know, thumping the pulpit, warning people, if you don't do this or listen to this, you're going to burn in hell. You know, to me, that's the wrong approach. What I've done is basically to tell the story of how I got this story from the various old-timers from the military and the intelligence community between 2001 and pretty much right up to the present era, and to present all the data. Now, you know, I mean, I know when people talk about, for example, you know, the memory metal and things like that, and I do admit, you know, that is an interesting aspect of the story that is hard to explain unless you're looking.
Yeah, my Uncle Mickey worked on the memory metal personally, so it's certainly a part of my family, and I know it was there. It was real.
Yeah. But as I said, one of the things I've found, again, is that when you look close, you do find these, you know, these Japanese threads. I mean, another one, for example, one of the witnesses who, everybody who is sort of a believer in the Roswell angle from the UFO perspective, talks about Melvin Brown, who was one of the guys who was stationed at Roswell. Now, in his testimony, although he said, you know, he saw these strange bodies and knew something had come down, his exact quote was, they could have passed for Chinese people. Now, you know, that's sort of not the greys, and those are his actual words. And there's a well-respected researcher in Australia named Keith Basterfield, and Keith contacted me some years ago after I first started talking about this theory, and he said, well, hang on a minute. He said, I was actually given this story by sources in Australia years ago when he was given this story, and it was almost identical with these gigantic balloons being test flown over New Mexico, and one of them being like an aerial mishap, and the thing comes down on the ranch, where on the one location you have the craft come down because it was heavy and just fell to the ground. Then you had the balloon part of it being lighter, being carried through the wind. So there were two different distinct sites, And that was exactly what I was told. Now, that, of course, doesn't prove anything, but what it does demonstrate is that whether truth or disinformation, somebody has quietly been disseminating this Japanese connection to Roswell to various researchers. Even Popular Mechanics magazine, they've published an article saying they were told of what would be a Japanese equivalent of paperclip, that the files were going to surface. Now, they haven't so far. But even if it is disinformation, you know, if it was just me being told the story, I would be highly suspicious, you know, because if I'd just been targeted and nobody else had been given it, I would be very, very suspicious of that. But the fact that people like Keith Basterfield, Melvin Brown, Popular Mechanics were all talking about this, that's what leads me to have an interest in it. You know, I'm not, like I said, I'm not saying this is the answer because I don't have proof. But what I can say is that it is an interesting angle with multiple threads when you start to look into it.
Well, I agree there. It is an interesting angle. I had made quite an effort to find out from the people I was talking to, my uncle chiefly and General Arthur Exon, who both were at Wright Field and observed the materials, what the bodies were like, and neither of them would admit to having seen the bodies at all, which is interesting to me because they were telling me everything about the materials and about the relationship between the scientific committee that was working on it and the CIA involvement and the Air Force's decision to make it secret and Truman's involvement, really opening the whole story up for me. But I never could find out anything about the bodies, which is really why you're on the air, because I think you have a real uphill battle here.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Yeah. However, I want to talk more about what you have found out about the bodies. And Free Dreamlanders, before we do that, listen up. We're back talking to Nick Redfern, his new book, The Roswell UFO Conspiracy, Exposing a Shocking and Sinister Secret. And now we're going to zero in on these bodies, Nick. And what in the world, what have you found out?
Well, the story that I got was that between sort of May 1947 and the latter part of 1947, there were five or six such experiments undertaken in New Mexico, and that other than Roswell, all the rest were completely shrouded in secrecy, and nobody did find out outside of the military. Nobody knew about it. The only reason the Roswell one became public domain, if you like, and everybody knew about it, it was in the papers, was because, unlike the other crashes where the military got there first, in the Roswell case, the rancher, Mac Brazel, got there before the military, contacted the local sheriff, who then contacted the Roswell guys at the base, and then the media got onto it, the local press. So in other words, the story was out before it could be contained. And all the people who I interviewed said that for these five or six experiments, including Roswell, basically, what, up until that point, you know, there have been a lot of flights with rockets and high-altitude balloons involving rats, mice, and then larger animals like monkeys and chimpanzees. And there are even rumors of pigs being used in some of these experiments where they, you know, they would literally go to the fringes of the atmosphere with these rockets and with these high-altitude balloons. So it's like, but we're still sort of 10 years before the space program itself really began. But this was the sort of formative years of extremely high altitude exposure. Now, the point came, I was told, when, you know, the call went out, we need human test subjects to do this. And, of course, you know, this was highly controversial and highly secret. And so what I was told and what Keith Basterfield was also told, was that to keep the whole thing hidden was to get people essentially against their will and who would not be missed. We're talking about people who, you know, had physical handicaps, psychological issues, prisoners and who basically they wanted people who wouldn't be missed. So that way, you know, if people were pulled off the streets or anything like that, or say, you know, even if somebody volunteered and they were killed, then, you know, they'd have to create a cover story because of these highly sort of technical and secret experiments into the early fringes of space. So, in other words, the controversial story is that some of these people were taken from asylums and hospitals. Some of them were physically handicapped and in some cases had various conditions which caused dwarfism. Now, they didn't take people who were suffering from dwarfism because that's what they wanted. It was because they were people who wouldn't be missed. Because unfortunately, back then, you know, there's a lot of stigma with regard to what, you know, back then people would call handicaps, you know, whether physical or psychological. Today, of course, we're more, fortunately today, we're more sort of very open-minded, you know, and everything's cool. But back then, it wasn't like that. So, in other words, the story I got was that when the military or the civilians saw this wreckage, this huge balloon wreckage, and these small bodies, you know, you put two and two together and think UFO. But they were saying, well, no, if you look at it from the perspective of that some of these people using the experiments were people with sort of chromosome issues, genetic issues, which, you know, created in a couple of cases dwarfism, things like this. As I said, they didn't use them because that's what they wanted. The whole issue revolved around people who would not be missed or not be noticed they were gone. And so, again, they said that's what led to the legends of the little, you know, the little people, so to speak, or little aliens. And, of course, the official record does tell that with these balloons that Japan was going to fly over, these kamikaze balloons, if the war had continued, they were looking at guys who were very, you know, sort of light, lithe, and not taller than 5 feet tall. And so the people I interviewed basically said, just put all those pieces together and you'll get the story of what happened at Roswell. Now, again, like you said, this is an uphill battle. And it certainly is, you know, and I don't mind a good battle, you know.
No.
But I wouldn't want to stress.
We're here to explore it too. Yeah. I mean, we're not, yeah. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm only saying that's not what I'm doing here. What I am saying is that you do have an uphill battle. It's true.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I wouldn't want people to think I've become a UFO skeptic or a UFO debunker. I'm not. You know, I'm a full-on believer in the existence of a very real, intimate, in terms of how it relates to us, UFO phenomenon. But I'm sort of talking about just one case, which just happens to be ufology's biggest case. But it doesn't, I think what we should do with, you know, ufology is look at each case on its own merit rather than just jump into, you know, and say that these are all interconnected, which, you know, may not be the case. So,
yes.
You know, all I can do is sort of put the story out, tell it sort of logically and chronologically, and the stories that I was told and the stories that the other people were told. I mean, Keith Basterfield in Australia, for example, he was told exactly the same. He was told by his source that the people they got were taken from a facility. Now, a lot of people don't know that literally almost within stone's throwing distance from the Foster Ranch, which is where rancher Matt Brazel found the wreckage. I mean, when I say it's literally down the road, I'm not hardly exaggerating. There's an old military base called Fort Stanton. Now, in the 1940s, when the Second World War was on, numerous Japanese people were held there as so-called enemy aliens or potentially enemy aliens. And also, right after the war, it was also a home to a lot of people who had severe physical handicaps. And that's just, as I said, that's down the road from where the event occurred on the Foster Ranch. Now, again, that doesn't prove anything, but it does demonstrate sort of another Japanese angle and a handicapped person angle at a military base, which is just a very, very short drive from the ranch itself. Now, as I said, does it prove anything? No, it doesn't. But it is another sort of little intriguing piece of a jigsaw that may come together, or which, you know, I have to admit, and I do admit in the book, could be another layer of disinformation. You know, we just don't really know.
Now, speaking of which, you mentioned Annie Jacobson's work in the book. And I think we're getting coming up on the end of the first half hour. Yes, we are. But in the second half hour, there were a few things that we're going to be talking about.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about researchers and deception. We're going to be talking about bodies. And we're going to also be talking, and in a broader sense than just Roswell, about children, the uses of children, which I know you know a good bit about, and where that whole thing may come in. So, free Dreamlanders, can you imagine in your wildest dreams how exciting the second half of the show is going to be? The answer is you can't. Because you're not subscribers, you can't find out either. So, subscribe today. Find out how cool this all really is. Not only can you listen to Nick struggling with the noose around his neck, the Roswell noose around his neck, you can hear Nick talking about incredibly cool stuff over the years on unknowncountry.com in the Dreamland archive. So there's a lot there, and there's a lot to Nick Redfern. Before we go leave our free Dreamlanders, Nick, what are you working on now? It's always an interesting question with you.
Well, my next book comes out in September, and it's a very different book. It's sort of it crosses over between the paranormal and my other big interest, which is cryptozoology, unknown animals, and it's called Shapeshifters, and it's a study of throughout history, folklore, mythology, legend, cryptozoology, UFOs, entities and creatures that can reportedly shapeshift, you know, and manipulate their image as we see them. So, you know, it covers everything from obviously things like legends of werewolves, but also Native American skinwalkers and African tales of leopard cults and things like this. So, in other words, it sort of covers the whole gamut, if you like, of shape-shifting entities throughout history and legend.